any questions you might have for the representative from Bessie. And then we can go to questions that we might have for staff. And then if you have any legal concerns, the council is here and you can ask legal questions, and we'll do it in that order. And that way, I think it'll help us all organize those answers in a proper manner. And why don't we start with Mr. Cox, if you have questions for Beacon.
Well, first of all, I'd like to applaud you on the work and the effort you've done to make it so you can start doing work out there on the platform. I know you've been here a few times, and we've had some challenging questions for you at times. I guess the one overarching question I have, and really I'm not sure if it is who it's for, so maybe we can help out here. I understand the well intervention, doing a well intervention program does not fall under the partial stay agreement. And when I look at the things that you're planning on doing, you know, 6 months after the resolution, you'll identify the rigs or the what needs to, you know, the fugitive leak repairs. Starting to develop a plan, not implementing the program, but starting to develop the plan, can that be done, or does a partial stay agreement say you can't even start developing a plan? And I'm not sure who that goes to.
I don't think I can answer that question.
Okay. I mean, so I'm just trying to figure out, I mean, before you do a program, you need a plan, right? And it can take months, years to do a plan. And so I'm trying to figure out is, as we wait for this resolution, is there a way we can be ahead of the power curve, or are we going to have to then wait another 6, 8, 12, 18 months before a plan is even done?
I think so what I can offer...
Maybe I can address that.
Go ahead, Denny.
So a well intervention program is not a... you don't take it off the shelf and just decide how you're going to do it. Every operator will do it slightly different, particularly when you think of the reservoir isolation methods, right? There's a standard, a minimum standard. There's a gold standard, and there's the whole range in between. So could a plan be prepared? Well, of course, in theory, anything could be done. But the plan should be prepared and must be prepared by the party that's actually going to do the work. And because that still remains undecided, it would be an investment potentially with no value. And it might not actually shorten the time. In fact, it might increase it, because then you're going to be evaluating the initial plan while you're thinking about the revision. So there is no real advantage to starting a plan until you're ready to proceed with the work. The other option too is, and that's why if you look at the increments of progress, there are several steps. There is limited equipment availability on the West Coast when we talk about a plug and abandonment strategy. So what type of rig and what type of procedure. So again, when you do the planning, you have to make certain commitments up front to secure the equipment such that the plan will work. So again, you wouldn't really start that until you understand that, yes, that's the commitment we're going through, and here are the steps that we have to go through, which are pretty much the increments of progress that were described. But to answer the question clearly, could it be started early? Of course, anything could be done, but it doesn't make it valuable, because it has to be the party, and this is my opinion, I would never take somebody else's plan. The party who's going to do the work needs to develop the plan. Did that answer the concern?
Yes, it does. I mean, it's kind of a chicken and an egg thing here.
It is.
So, because, I mean, Beacon West has stepped up and said, hey, within the IBLA, once we know who it's going to do, you know, within 6 months we're going to identify these things, and with 18 months we're going to do certain things. I mean, that kind of sounds like the beginning of a plan, right? I don't know.
I think the point being is that planning cannot occur until after the IBLA decision is made. and for the reasons that Danny mentioned, is that no operator, no matter who it may be, it could be any one of the order recipients, is not going to do that planning until they understand that they have that responsibility. And right now, that's not confirmed.
Okay, I mean, I understand that. Does that mean the timelines you have laid out here for the Beacon West response on the findings, you know, the 6 months, 18 months, 20 months, 38 months, are those, for lack of a better word, pie in the sky? I mean, can you start doing those before plan is completed?
Not pie in the sky. I would consider that timing to be industry standard timing for planning and implementation of a well intervention program.
Okay. All right. So it isn't like suddenly the plan would be developed. It would take, let's say, 6 months to develop the plan, which is when you've said by that point you will have already identified a few of the items that need to be worked. And it doesn't come back and say, oh, that those 6 months that you've used to identify are kind of wasted time because it doesn't fit into the plan. So the things you've identified are kind of standard for what would be done on a regular basis for what we're doing here. Does that make sense?
First, actually, I'm not a well intervention person. But again, standard industry practice timing.
Okay. Thank you. That was my primary.
Do you have further questions for staff?
No.
All right. Dr. Colomy, please.
Not to be comical about this, but when I received this packet, I couldn't help but think of Bill Murray in Groundhog Day. We've really seen this repeatedly. I do want to say that I appreciate all of the effort that you have done toward making these platforms manageable. They're clearly a tremendous amount of work. There were no dollar amounts that were explicitly given here. And in the end, I think that, and I'll pursue this a little bit, is about money. It's about ConocoPhillips attempting through the IBLA to absolve itself of responsibility for the well cleanup. Just the number of staff hours that you've put in, I figure we're talking about in the $10 million range just for staff time. So the efforts have been considerable. One of my questions is how much of the work that you've done has been covered by the bond that was issued that was Signal Hill's bond that was passed off to ConocoPhillips.
So I will address that one. Your order, you're a little bit shy on the amount of investment, but I do appreciate how you did the calculation. The amount of funds that were made available from the bond was $498,000. That did not even get us through 2021, not even close.
So then my next question is really in terms of the timing of the IBLA hearing. I mean, I think there were parts of this that said these hearings take time and it may take up to 5 years. So we would continue, presumably, with Beacon West doing the maintenance work during that time period. What are the possible outcomes? Either ConocoPhillips not being responsible, and then who's the responsible party? I'm assuming it's the public, it's the taxpayer that would be the responsible party if ConocoPhillips were to prevail. In either case, we know that the ultimate outcome of this process has got to be full decommissioning of these platforms and closing off of the wells. So again, I would reflect on Mr. Cox's comment that, you know, why don't we start thinking about a reasonable process? I can't imagine anyone other than Beacon West having a clear picture at this point of the conditions and needs to move toward full decommissioning than Beacon West.
Beacon West will continue to perform the maintenance and monitoring activities that our client requests us to do. That does not include any well intervention work or planning. Perhaps Mr. Heskin can speak to the IBLA decision timing and those details.
Mr. Heskin, please.
Yeah, I actually spoke with Matt Ballinger. He's our supervisory attorney advisor to Bessie, our office, and anticipated there'd be some questions about the timing of the IBLA decision. I'll just pretty much read what he provided to me through email. Our discussion has to do when a decision would be forthcoming from IBLA. Matt said, we can only really provide educated guesses based on recent experience. The real answer depends on prospective IBLA staffing levels, docket flow, nature of disputes presented to them, panel assignments, and many other factors Bessie cannot control or have too significant insights into. Our group's oldest currently pending case still awaits decision, still awaiting decision, was fully briefed as of five and a half years ago. And we have a couple others that have been fully briefed for more than 5 years without a decision. That said, we have gotten decisions in other cases that have been pending in less time. These have been fully briefed for 2 years. So it may be another three years based on recent experience, but it could be sooner. And the other, I guess, part of that question would be, is there something that Bessie or someone else can do to speed up the process? And Matt's response to that was no, not in any meaningful sense, at least in my experience. The parties could file a motion for expedited consideration, but I've never seen the IBLA grant one of those. Everyone with an appeal pending views the prompt resolution of their dispute to be important, and the board is generally reluctant to let cases jump in line because the parties ask. Given the stable negotiated status quo that we have with ConocoPhillips, such a motion would have very low probability of success. So that would be Matt's response to that. And again, he's very knowledgeable of this situation, the history. There's a lot of history with this, and he's more than glad to speak to legal counsel to provide any other answers, any legal questions that you may have. Thank you.
Mr. Cox.
Well, I guess, Chair Dressler, I don't know, I have a question, a reaction. It's a lot of progress based on where we reports that have been made in the past. I'm impressed with the progress that's been made, the cranes that have been put into service. Thank you for those efforts. That's all I have to say.
All right. So my questions are focused on helping the hearing board make the findings that we're statutorily required to make. In the staff or in the petition and in your testimony, I detected some ambiguity about whether there was violation or not. In the one hand, there were statements that the facility is violating Rule 331. On the other hand, there was a statement about how since there are no responsible parties, nobody's in violation. Okay. So what I need to hear from you is a very clear statement that this platform, as currently configured, is in violation of APCD rules and permit conditions.
The platform is.
I was just going to say, would you like me to address that one, Keith?
Sure, Danny, go ahead.
All right, we'll be crystal clear. Both platforms are in violation of the current regulation. The petitioner, on the other hand, may be a different question. because there is no template for this particular situation where the monitoring maintenance contractor is going in and refurbishing a platform for the ultimate owner to decommission it. So the platforms are in violation, clearly. Petitioner, not so clear.
All right. Thank you. My next question is regarding the requirement that the hearing board must make a finding that refusing to grant this variance would be a taking. There was some ambiguous statements both in the petition and in the testimony about how there's nothing to be taken. And yet, further on in the testimony and in the petition, it is repeated that this taking would require a cessation of work and cause, you know, more air pollution. So those statements are in variance with each other. And my question here, and this is a kind of a legal question, but is the thing to be taken that you are worried that will be taken or that you're claiming will be taken, is the permit itself? Is the permit the entitlement to operate?
Okay. Unfortunately, I'm not a lawyer, so you're going to get a layman's interpretation from my understanding. The taking would be the ability to comply with the partial stay agreement. And I think there's a public value to completing the partial stay in the sense that the platforms are maintained for eventual decommissioning and removal, plug abandonment, decommissioning and removal. So although if you think of property, the actual platforms, I think everybody would be very happy if somebody would take them. But you know, that's not going to happen. They're not going to go away. So really it's around the ability to comply with the partial stay agreement. And that's why you'll read in part of the presentation that without having the protection of a variance, we believe that the physical work of maintenance and refurbishment could not continue because that would require the permit and would require the variances to be able to execute work under that permit.
All right. Perhaps our counsel can help us here. Is there a property interest in the permit?
Chair Dressler, generally there is a property interest in a vested permit.
Thank you. Therefore, taking an action that would potentially, in the long term, be a forced cancellation of the permit could be interpreted as being a taking. Is that a correct statement?
Chair Dressler, I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
Taking an action that could ultimately result in the cancellation of the permit by this body could be considered a taking since there's a property interest in the permit.
Chair Dressler, generally, yes, that is correct.
Thank you. All right, next question. Is the well rig absolutely necessary to establish the well intervention program necessary for the repairing of the fugitive leaks at the wellheads?
Yes.
Thank you. Is it currently not feasible to immediately put a well rig on platform Houchin?
Yes.
Thank you. All right. So that's all my questions that I have for the applicant, for the petitioner. And I would like to move now to questions, for any further questions that we have for Mr. Hessen from Bessie. So I'll start again with Mr. Cox.
No questions.
Again, just following up on who are the participants in the IVLA hearing now, is it possible for the APCD or the county to become a party in those proceedings, since there clearly is an interest in the outcome?
My apologies, I'm a little bit hard of hearing. Oh. Could I ask you please to repeat the question?
Sure, the question regards, and I know you're not responsible for the IBLA hearing, but you are a party. Bessie is a party to that hearing, is that correct?
Yes.
So the question is whether either the APCD or the county could participate as a party in that, since the APCD has an interest in the outcome.
Not to my knowledge. That's something I could check with Matt Ballinger, our legal counsel. But really, statement of reasons have been filed by Bessie and by the predecessor's attorneys. And it's my understanding the issue just resides exclusively with the board now. They're not considering any additional comments or statements.
And are the dichotomous outcomes of that either ConocoPhillips remains responsible for the well closure, or it does not, in which case I'm assuming the only party that's going to hold this hot potato is the public?
We'll have to wait for a decision from IBLA, and to see who is responsible.
So again, what are the potential outcomes of that hearing?
Potential outcomes would be a ruling favorable to Bessie. According to due process, ConocoPhillips could still appeal through the federal court system. And if it was an unfavorable ruling for Bessie, then we would have to develop contingency planning to go ahead and assume those accrued responsibilities.
And maybe I could just add a little bit. I mean, we're talking very specifically about ConocoPhillips and what they could do. Just to be clear, the order goes out to three order recipients. ConocoPhillips is but one party, and is the only party that agreed to stand up and lead the effort. So although we are working with the other two order recipients, right now we're doing it alone, but it should not be construed that the liability would be 100% ConocoPhillips. The liability is joint and several, and pending the IBLA outcome.
No questions.
All right, Mr. Hessen. Term 2 of the partial stay agreement states that the monitoring and maintenance required under the agreement will be limited to work reasonably necessary to maintain safety and environmental protection. Why is it that the work necessary to bring the platform into compliance is, which is part of, I mean, why we issue, or why the district issues permits, is for environmental protection. Why was it seemed to me, an arbitrary line drawn at the well intervention as beyond the requirements of the partial stay?
Yeah, I, I would have to defer to our solicitor's office to respond to that question. I was not part of those discussions when our legal counsel was discussing this with the legal representation for ConocoPhillips, Devon Energy, and Occidental Petroleum. So would respectfully ask that I could refer that question to our attorney, Matt Ballinger, who's our representative.
Okay, thank you. Does ConocoPhillips have any insight into that answer to that question?
Unfortunately, I was not part of the initial discussion, so I don't have anything further to add.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, I had some questions regarding statements that seem to indemnify all the parties from APCD rules, but the APCD wasn't included in the agreement, and therefore I didn't know where the authority was to provide those indemnifications. But since that's a legal question that probably nobody knows the answer to here, I will skip those questions. And I think you've answered the question about who has the ultimate responsibility should the IBLA find in favor of the legacy owners. And I think I heard you say that would most likely be the Department of the Interior itself.
Yes, that is correct.
Okay, thank you. So let's move to questions that we might have, that the board might have for staff. Mr. Cox.
I don't know, this may be a simple question as I'm going through everything and you've got tables and all that. The permits and the waivers and everything we're talking about, are they in violation of emissions or equipment maintenance, essentially?
So I apologize for the sound. This is Caitlin McNally from the district. And so the fugitive component violations are both emissions and maintenance type requirements, because there are leaks that have been discovered from components.
But from what I understand, those emissions are so small they can't really measure those, correct?
So we can measure the concentration mm-hmm. of hydrocarbons in the leaks, but we do not have a method to measure the emission rate, such as pounds per hour of emissions occurring from those leaks.
Okay, so we wouldn't know if they were actually violating the authorized emissions in accordance with the permit?
So the rule that's applicable to those components and the permit requirements do have a concentration limit. So okay. They are in violation of the hydrocarbon concentration limits in the rule.
Okay. All right. So it is both equipment and emissions that we're asking the board for. Okay. Thank you.
I believe so.
That's all the questions I have.
So with the flares now in operation, does that eliminate the quantifiable VOC emissions that have been in the tables in terms of past emissions?
Yes, that is correct. We do not expect any further excess emissions calculations to be included in the monthly reports. However, there is a requirement that they identify all leaks that they detect when they're doing their inspections and monitoring. So those would still be identified with a concentration limit if they're doing it per the method of the rule.
So that's the fugitive emissions from
yes.
the valves and various connections. And how often, I'm assuming it's a handheld VOC monitor that's being used to determine that?
I'll defer to Beacon West for that question.
That's correct.
Yeah. And how often is that inspection at the relevant valves conducted?
Quarterly, as required by Rule 331.
Okay, thanks.
Mr. Peters.
From Caitlin, hello. What else does the district have to say about this? We're basically in the same situation where they're making progress, but we don't have a lot of options other than approving the variance.
Yes, so thank you, Member Peters. I did wanna say that the district does support the variance, and because we believe that the six findings can be made by the hearing board, and because we believe that the alternative would not improve the return to compliance, I did want to focus on the first finding since there were questions about it earlier. So for finding one, the language of the Health and Safety Code section does state that the petitioner for a variance is or will be in violation. And although it says the petitioner must be in violation, we believe that your hearing board could interpret this finding more broadly to mean that the stationary source or the platform is in violation, which is true. Furthermore, this broad interpretation would be consistent with the authority the district has under District Rule 1305 to enforce rules and regulations when Part 70 sources are in violation without the need to have a clear owner or operator. That's how our rules are written. So we feel that this is an important distinction because with the IBLA appeal, at this time there's no clear party responsible for compliance, as the representative from BSEE stated, and the district is in agreement with that. So this broad interpretation would allow your hearing board to make the finding without that clear responsible party, and that is consistent with how the district would enforce our requirements even without a clear responsible party.
Thank you.
No further questions. Sorry, I had one more thing. I did want to get into a little more detail on the alternative as well. So, you know, we believe that the variance is the best route because if a variance is not approved, the alternative is that the source would be in violation and after the current variance ends on July 30th. The district would then issue a notice of violation or NOV. However, even after researching it, as I said earlier, there's currently no clear responsible party for this situation, so there could be legal challenges. We would still issue a violation, but those legal challenges would take a lot of district time and money to potentially work through if that did happen. And until the legally responsible party is determined, the district may not be able to successfully use all of our enforcement tools available, including compliance agreements with monetary penalties, abatement orders, or injunctions through the district attorney's office. So for that reason, we don't believe the alternative would speed up compliance in any way. And in the near term, we assume the best case scenario would be the same as it would be under a variance in terms of emissions and the compliance status, and it could even be potentially worse. Thank you.
All right. To that point, it seems to me that, and I'm sure that the Bureau of Enforcement, of Safety and or Environmental Enforcement can see this too, that there's a loophole in the ability to enforce regulations if there can be a situation where there's no responsible party. And it seems like that could interfere with the whole legal regime of issuing permits or granting leases if ultimately there's no one responsible. Has the district thought about, I mean, there are several other platforms that we're going to be dealing with here. And actually, some of them are beginning to change hands to other entities that don't seem to have as deep pockets as some other entities. And has the district or Bessie considered this loophole and how it might interfere with the efficient, effective, and rapid decommissioning of these platforms?
From the district's perspective, I think that we are keeping an eye on that. I think the good news is that the other platforms, as far as I understand, are not in the same situation as these, and this the deteriorated state of these platform, or this platform, Houchin in this case, does add a complication that the other platforms luckily do not have. As of right now, we have not run into the same situation with any of the other platforms, but we are aware of trying to make sure that we have the ability to enforce our permits and rules and requirements in general for oil and gas in our area. And so we are actually working with the State Air Resources Board to see if there's anything that they can do to tighten up a regulation they have for greenhouse gas emissions for oil and gas operators in onshore. It does not address the offshore, but I did want to point that out, that that is something we are looking at and looking at different ways to help our success and ability to enforce in the future.
Okay.
Did you want to hear from Bessie as well on that?
If you have any input into that.
Yeah, I wanted to mention that, you know, BOEM, the other agency that I mentioned, they're the ones who handle the financial assurances for all of the platforms in the Pacific region. But based on my review of those assignments, Hogan and Houchin is a unique situation as far as the Pacific region. Financial assurances for all the other platforms are guaranteed through major companies, Chevron, Freeport-McMoRan, ExxonMobil, of course, and then the Beta project off of Huntington Beach is through Era Energy and Shell. So I would characterize this situation as unique to the Pacific region.
Okay, thank you. Caitlin, I have a couple of niggling little questions. There are two dates mentioned in the materials that I read regarding when Signal Hill, PUI, actually notified, you know, the Interior Department that they were bailing. And one of them is a September 2019 date that was in the staff report, and the other is this October 14th, 2020 date, which is the information that's sitting in the partial stay agreement and other places. And I wonder if you could clear up that discrepancy for me.
Yeah, so they weren't meant to be the same date, or this describing the same situation, but I can see how that could be confusing. So I recommend just removing the October date because the September date, and keeping the October date that was in the petition and materials from Bessie to be more consistent and clear, because that's the more pertinent information for the case.
Okay, thank you. This is another question I have for, actually, I'm gonna save this question for council. So
okay.
Go ahead. That's it
okay,
for me.
Thank you.
So now we will move to any questions that the hearing board may have for council, any kind of legal clarification that they would like to have.